on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. It is one of our favorites, the annual Time Capsule Extravaganza. What were the items that best encapsulated the 2025 MLB season? We will run through them. We will chat about what they mean, and then we will theoretically put them into the ground to live for all eternity. It is a long one. It is a fun one, but it is a necessary one. So buckle up, grab yourself some hot cider and a turkey leg, and here we go. Let's dig a hole. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows there is nothing more underground than a time capsule. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And while things may just be things, they are much more than things.
Welcome, friends, to the sixth annual Baseball Barbacast Time Capsule. This podcast wasn't even called Baseball Barbacast when we started this bit way back in 2020 with our pal Bobby Wagner. But we have kept it going through many iterations of this show, and it is something we are quite proud of, something that we enjoy so much. And that is why we are running it back once again. What is this exercise that we do here that we call the Baseball Barbacast Time Capsule? Jake, we have many a caveat, many a things that we need to lay out before we get started.
Sure.
But in its simplest form, please explain what it is we are about to do.
So you're smart, my listener friend. You probably know what a time capsule is, right? It is typically a container that goes underground with a selection of items from the current day that is set to be opened at a moment in the future. And therefore, the capsule is a representation of what life was like at a place, at a time, for the future humans to appreciate and learn. But what this episode is slightly different, because none of the items, very few of the items that will go into our proverbial time capsule, are actually acquirable by us. Therefore, it is merely an exercise, a thought exercise, of what would go in the time capsule of the 2025 Major League Baseball season. If we could have access to any item in the world and we could put it in the time capsule, what would those items be? Now, we do not set a maximum amount of items. We do not set a maximum size for any given item. I would say there are two core principles that lead us on this path. One is no people. You cannot put people in the time capsule. You cannot put people underground. That is not cool, to put living people underground. So we won't do that. The second thing is we do our best at all turns to avoid player-worn jerseys or balls or bats or shoes or helmets as much as we can. Those things are cool, and they are representative of
moments.
We'll
have some. There will be a couple in there where we keep it simple. But we try to broaden the horizons for what would be collected as memorabilia, because again, as Jake said, we are not actually getting these things. So we're just going to say that we are, as opposed to it being, you know, the Hall of Fame's job to actually acquire said items, which is why, you know, oftentimes they do land on those select few bits of, you know, whether it's a jersey, whether it's a ball or so. So we try to get creative every year, you know, and sometimes we run into the same kinds of obstacles, but I think we do have a nice refreshing round of new items to put in this year.
I totally agree. This is a joyful trip down memory lane. I enjoyed constructing this list with you, Jordan. We enjoyed receiving some submissions from listeners, both on a Twit machine and on the email machine. Some of those are incorporated. We will let you know when they are. But without a single additional ado, should we get underway?
Yeah, I think my last caveat is we will certainly forget things. It's a long season. We did our best to go back. We are going to do this chronologically because we think that that is kind of a fun way to reflect back on the season and be like, oh, man, that happened on that date. Oh, that was then. Not every team will be represented. There will be storylines that we miss, some of which has been an editorial decision, some of which I'm sure we completely flubbed. And you should let us know at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. But as you said, yes, Jake, this is really just a good way to wrap up the season and officially put it to bed or put it in the ground. I am wearing my Avril Lavigne Greatest Hits Tour t-shirt. This will be the greatest hits of 2025, wow, as well as some hits that you definitely forgot. Jake, we begin, of course, on the other side of the world. In Tokyo, where this season began, we decided against including any spring training items. If we forgot any spring training storylines, let us know. We begin in the Tokyo series, Jake, and we have two items from the Tokyo series that we would like to put in to our time capsule. And we begin with, of course, the most important baseball player in the world, and that is Shohei Ohtani. In the second game between the Dodgers and the Cubs, way back on March 19th, Shohei Ohtani hit a home run. Or did he? The Dodgers won the first game, a fairly sleepy game, 4-1. Yamamoto was good. But in that first game, there were no home runs. However, in the second game, there was a home run. But there were actually a few home runs. We had Tommy Edman homered off Justin Steele. Remember Justin Steele? We had Kike Hernandez homered off Justin Steele. That home run, I remember. There was no doubt about that one. And then in the fifth inning, Shohei Ohtani hit a baseball very high to right center field off of Nate Pearson. And it appears that multiple fans wearing Shohei Ohtani jerseys reached over and hit the ball that then fell down onto the outfield warning track, then interfered, and it didn't look like a home run. But they reviewed it, and they were like, you know what? Shohei Ohtani in Tokyo, second game of the season. Are we really going to party poop this with a replay review? No, we are not. Shohei Ohtani, there's your first homer of the season. And we are going to take the fans' jerseys, the Ohtani jerseys, many of which were worn at the Tokyo Dome on this day. We're just going to take these two closest to the Ohtani incident, and we are going to put them in our time capsule.
I would say this moment stands out because you and I are not particularly susceptible to conspiracy theories.
No.
At all.
Not at
and
all.
And yet, this was the closest I have ever come to the MLB is pushing the scales for Shohei Ohtani. Because this, when you watch it back, was so clearly not a home run. And the league, whoever was in charge, was just like, you know what?
Yeah,
like,
screw it. And hey, maybe replay. Maybe there's an angle that we didn't see. That was also part of the fun of it. Is like they didn't really show it that many times because they were like, "Ooh, this is gonna look bad." Again, I am so for MLB promoting Ohtani literally at every turn. I wish they tweeted all caps Ohtani stuff more often so that more fans could get annoyed that the amazing baseball player of all time is getting quote unquote too much love. No, it's ridiculous. We love Ohtani. He deserves all the credit in the world. But this was one situation where I was just like, and again, maybe it was 8 a.m. and we were just like, come on, guys. But we laughed at this. So kind of a funky way to start this off, but I stand by it.
I just think that if Michael Conforto had hit that ball, they would have spent a little more time on the review. I'll just leave it at that. The other Tokyo series item that we're throwing in there is Pete Crow Armstrong's Takashi Murakami beanie. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's totally fine. You can go on eBay your damn self and purchase one of these hats for a cool $399.99 in U.S. currency. Major League Baseball and this artist, Takashi Murakami, did a collaboration with like a bunch of Cubs and Dodgers gear ahead of the Tokyo series. And there was this cool beanie in a Cubs blue with a bunch of flowers stitched on there. And PCA got one. And then proceeded to wear it effectively every single day of the baseball season. There's an interview that he did with Chris Rose over at John Boy Media in the middle of July, right before the All-Star game in Anaheim, where PCA is outside wearing the hat. It never left his head, except for games when he was playing. And we felt that PCA should be represented in the time capsule because he was one of the more important storylines of the year.
Yeah, and to us, the biggest Cubs story. Obviously, Kyle Tucker being on the Cubs was a big deal, but PCA, especially for those first few months, was just an unbelievable. And honestly, for how bad he was in the second half, that was also a very memorable turn of events. So that is our Cubs representation. Again, we didn't try to put everything, you know, make sure every team was represented, but PCA, absolutely one of the biggest stories of the year. And we will take his beanie into the time capsule. All right, we move to the actual regular season. And folks, where else to begin but in the Bronx with the absolute home run barrage that the Yankees delivered against the Milwaukee Brewers over the weekend. Jake, you were there. You covered, I think, either all of these games or at least two of them. And of course, folks, this is very simple. The Torpedo Bats. Yes, that was this season. The Torpedo Bats craze was brief, but my goodness, did it make us do a lot of work. Let's decide whose Torpedo Bat is the most appropriate to put into the time capsule. Again, folks, if you don't remember, the Yankees hit 9 home runs in the second game of the season against the Milwaukee Brewers. They won 20-9. They also hit a few more that weekend, sweeping the Brewers in what I believe was the only time the Brewers got swept all season. So that is a hilarious thing to kind of add to the significance of this weekend. But yes, the Yankees were swinging silly bats and every ball was going over the fence. So which silly bat are we putting in the time capsule?
Has to be Anthony Volpe's silly bat, because for those first two games after the Brewers got bludgeoned by the Yankees, Anthony Volpe was hitting a cool 250, 400, 1,000 with 2 home runs. And it was like, oh my God, is this bat going to propel Anthony Volpe into an all-star power hitter? I would say that at the end of the season, the answer was a pretty resounding no, as he finished with just 19 home runs and an 83 OPS plus. But it really just goes to exemplify how big of a deal that was, right? The extent to which torpedo bats crossed over says something about our society. Some of it good, much of it weird, some of it bad. It was the most fad baseball thing I can remember since fighting necklaces.
Yeah.
And it was not harmful in any way. It was just a very silly thing. And we would be, doing a disservice if we did not include one of these torpedo bats in the time capsule.
Yeah. And I think Volpe's, and hey, Volpe then homered 2 more times in their next series against Arizona. So he had 4 in his first 5 games. Many more hits after that. We know there was a lot that went on with Volpe's season that we will then remember courtesy of this bat. But I do think that Volpe's in particular, something that we learned as we started to research and understand these bats, is that some looked goofier than others. And Volpe's really did have the most bulbous bowling pin shape bat. Like, that was when I'm picturing a bat that looks silly and looks torpedo bat like, it's the one that Volpe was seeing. Because some of the other ones were way more subtle, and you'd really have to kind of zoom in and be like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess that technically counts. But Volpe's, man, there was nothing subtle about that thing. And yeah, just the amount. And the number one question I do wonder still forever is just, if it wasn't the Yankees, how much would people have cared? If it wasn't the Yankees and they didn't score that, like if it was the same thing.
And the Brewers were healthy.
Right. Nestor Cortes wasn't pitching. But that's the other funniest part, is that the Brewers were just like being laughed at for, 3 straight days. And then, best record in baseball. More on the Brewers later. All right. We move to April 9th. Oh, my goodness. This is a big one. One of the biggest stories going into the season. What would happen with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and the Toronto Blue Jays? Would this be his final year in Toronto? Free agency looming.
Spoiler. Nope. Uh-oh. It wasn't.
Could they get a deal?
Could get traded.
We thought, they don't get it. Could he get traded? Oh, could he get traded?
He could still get.
And we thought, right, like, oh, well, if they don't get an extension done before opening day, like.
Oh, man.
Take to that. He's gone. And remember, also, another important thing. We were like, the Blue Jays stink. We're like, okay, great. Maybe you give them an extension. And on April 9th, they get it done. $500 million, 14 years for the face of the franchise. And most importantly, Canadian-born Vladimir Guerrero Jr., of course. And that is why the item we are going to take to celebrate Vlad Jr.'s season is his passport, his Canadian passport, which would be a massive inconvenience for him to have taken from him. However, I would imagine, sorry, after Vlad, the season that he just had, he could probably make a couple phone calls and and get a new passport in short order. So I don't feel bad taking. I don't feel bad. Oh yeah, Vlad might be one of the few people that could just show up to the border without a passport, and they just wait. You're good, man. Oh, yeah. Come on through,
Vladdy.
But I just think that he was the guy. He was the guy. And you know what? I went back and looked, and you know, you did your annual list going into the season, the most important people of the season. And Vlad Jr., I believe, was number two.
Yeah.
And you know, there was a version of this season where Vlad Jr. signs the extension.
Well, so yes.
And the Blue Jays are just kind of meh. And it's just like, cool, Vlad's on the Blue Jays. Like, I'm happy about that. We're all happy about that. But like, it's not that important.
That's not what, and to be clear, why I had him at number two was I thought, many of us thought, that Vlad was going to just do the Soto thing, right? Where it's like, how big of a year can he have before he gets to free agency, and how high can he get that number? And when the season starts and there's no extension, that's just where we think we're going. And instead, they come to the agreement. And honestly, like, he's really good during the regular season, right? And the Blue Jays have a great year. But I would not have said he was a top 10 most important player during the regular season until the playoffs. Nope. And then in the playoffs, you know what happened. He's the face of this franchise. He accomplishes everything but the last step. But boy, oh boy, did he raise his stock in the eyes of the nation. And in some ways, it was indeed the year of Vlad. Let's move forward. Skip ahead a month. We're flying. It's May 8th. And Kyle Freeland, starting pitcher for the Colorado Rockies, sheds a tear or two. By this point in the year, it was obvious already that the Rockies were terrible. On May 8th, the Rockies played a doubleheader. In the first game, Kyle Freeland, who is from Denver, who loves being a Rocky, allows 9 runs and they lose 10-2. They lose game 2, 11-1. And at this point, their record is what?
Is 6-31.
Oh.
So they're 6-31. And Kyle Freeland, after his outing. Goes to the podium. I believe in between games of the doubleheader. Maybe this was after the second game, but I'm pretty sure it was in between games. And Kyle Freeland just kind of lets it all hang out there in a way that is
as emotional as you'll ever see a player be. Relating to baseball things in May.
Yes, right. Great way to put it. And he just gets really emotional.
Keep believing in us.
He's shedding tears and he says, keep believing in us, stick with us, right? This is a Rockies lifer, both in his career and as a Colorado native. And after that, they lost game 2. 2 days later, they lose 21-0. They win the final game in that series against the Padres, but then Bud Black gets fired after a lot of losing. June 1st, they get swept. They drop to 9-50. And at that point, we're like, all right, like, Kyle Freeland tears be damned. Like, we're going White Sox. Your record's only going to stand for a year. But Warren Schaefer and the boys battle back and only lose 119 games. Kyle Freeland
once again.
Makes, I think, another 30 starts, right? That's what Kyle Freeland does. He shows up and pitches for the Rockies. But Kyle Freeland, we are taking Kyle Freeland's hoodie that he dabbed his tears with during this emotional press conference just 6 or 7 weeks into the season, right? I mean, they were far from rock bottom, but they were getting pretty close. And we obviously had to have something to commemorate the Rockies in 2025. And that is our choice, Kyle Freeland's tear-soaked hoodie.
One day later, after Kyle Freeman shed some tears, so did much of the world, as a new pope was chosen to lead the Catholic Church. Pope Leo the 14th, becoming the first American pope in the history of the church. Why do we care about that? Because he's the baseball pope, baby. Pope Leo, who is from Chicago, is like revealed to be a legitimate White Sox fan. And a photo of him at the 2005 World Series comes out. And in that picture, He is mid-phone call on just a perfect 2005 era cell phone. So we're going to go ahead and take that cell phone that the Pope is on, wherever it is, whoever he was talking to on the phone, presumably God. So we're going to take that phone and we're going to go ahead and throw it in the time capsule. Lord knows the Pope doesn't need it anymore.
Well said. Robert Prevost, yes, this photo, which came out courtesy of the Chicago Sun-Times. We should also point out, as we referenced earlier, oh, you know, what was the biggest story of the Cubs season? There was a couple hours there where the Cubs tried to claim the Pope as the Cubs fan.
They tried to claim the Pope.
I believe the Pope Leo's brother was like, what are you talking
about?
He's a White Sox fan.
Come on, Pope, the brakes.
Anyway, Pope Leo, the White Sox fan, which, by the way, great story in The Athletic, courtesy of John Greenberg, who spoke to future White Sox owner Justin Ishbia, who gave the Pope a White Sox gift. And wow. Anyway, so it's just great. Like, this is Pope the beginning fun. Of baseball Pope, but so much more to come.
There will be a baseball Pope related article in the time capsule for years to come. I feel pretty strongly that this is not the last time baseball Pope makes an appearance on the time capsule. And what is the Vatican if not a time capsule, by the way? Underneath, they've got all that stuff in there.
It will be interesting if this is an annual baseball Pope appearance, or if we don't see another Pope appearance until he throws out the first pitch at a White Sox game, which is
sure.
Hopefully that will happen. Hopefully. All right.
Hopefully.
We move forward to May 16th.
From a man beloved in Chicago to a man polarizing in New York, Juan Soto plays his first Subway Series match after departing the Bronx for Queens during the previous winter. The Mets headed into the Bronx for a 3-game Subway Series set against the Yankees. I was at those games. In his first plate, there was like the fans turning their backs to Soto as he ran out to the outfield. There was a whole lot of booing. But what we're going to put in here to commemorate Soto's first season with the Mets and the tension involved with the Yankees is the helmet that he wore up to that first plate appearance, because ever the showman, Juan Soto took the helmet off and tipped it to the crowd to say thank you as they booed him into oblivion.
And you can tell when you watch the video back, like, he knew exactly what he was doing. He's basically laughing. I think it's Austin Wells behind the plate. I assume it is. And Soto kind of gives him some love, and he's like, oh, man, here we go. Here we go. I also think that this is an important part of Soto's season, because this was also a time when Soto was struggling in a way that we really have not seen him struggle. There was a legitimate 3-week stretch where, yes, he was still reaching base. He wasn't good. It's true. He wasn't hitting. But because he's one of the greatest hitters of all time, yes, I said it, that is what Juan Soto is, yep. He was fine. He got back on track and finished third in NL MVP voting because, of course,
and everything was fine with the New York Mets.
Oh, more on that later.
May 25th.
May 25th. This is a double. A double header here. Fascinating double header here on May 25th. Little did we know how important this day would be.
Oh my God.
May 25th is a Sunday. And our first item on May 25th involves Tarek Skubal, who would go on to defend his AL Cy Young and win it once again. What happened on May 25th is that the Tigers and Guardians engaged in a morning baseball game. Yes, our favorite Roku morning leadoff.
RIP.
That means that the game began at 11:35 in the morning in Detroit. But you know who was ready? Tarek Skubal. You know who was not ready? The Guardians offense. Tarek Skubal basically gives us the best pitch game of the year. Complete game, 2 hits, no walks, 13 strikeouts. Final pitch of the game, only his 94th pitch, 102.6 miles an hour from Tarek Skubal. This was the best pitch game of the year. And the fact that it started at 11:35 a.m., we wanted to give Skubal some credit. How did he do it? We assume that he was as a great Philly once said, beaned up.
Hashtag beaned up.
We're going to take Tarek Skubal's coffee cup from that morning, whether he picked it up from a local coffee establishment in Detroit, whether he made it at the ballpark, however he consumed his coffee to be able to pitch one of the most dominant regular season outings we've seen in a long time at 11:35 a.m. first pitch. We're going to take that coffee cup and we're going to put it in the time capsule. But Jake, that was not the only memorable thing that happened on May 25th because you were in Queens. We just mentioned Queens. But this is not about the Mets.
There's a couple here, Jordan, in a nice run of things we saw in person. And on May 25th in the afternoon, Shohei Ohtani walked out to the mound at Citi Field and had his first live pitching session against hitters since undergoing Thomas Johnson surgery over a year and a half prior. It was the first time that he threw a pitch off a mound with hitters as a Los Angeles Dodger. He did it before the game against some of his teammates, including Dalton Rushing and Ha-Seong Kim. But most importantly, one of the game planning guys, JT Watkins, who is a coach, took an at-bat. And guess what? Ohtani made him look silly with a split finger from the great beyond. And we are going to go ahead and take the TrackMan unit, that like claw-like Demogorgon style, when U2 did that 360 concert, but that stage, but much smaller. We're going to take that technological device, which I believe are quite expensive, but we need one. And we're going to take that TrackMan unit that was behind home plate and we're going to put it in our time capsule because Shohei Ohtani returning to the mound was undeniably one of the biggest stories of 2025.
We move to May 28th. Let's stick with the Dodgers. Where did the Dodgers go?
Let's stick with things we saw in person and didn't know at the time how important it was going to be.
After their trip to the Mets, the Dodgers journeyed west to Cleveland, Ohio, where they took on the Fightin' Guardians.
I joined them.
And in the third game of this series, Andy Pages stepped to the plate against Emmanuel Clase. And in this at-bat, Emmanuel Clase decided to start him off with something soft, something down and out of the strike zone. And that was a slider in the dirt. And Andy Pages, dude likes to swing. He couldn't resist. He swung, strike one. All right, what's the big deal? Who cares?
Better find out.
Well, it turns out, folks, that this pitch that Andy Pages swung at was the one time during a multi-year scheme, scandal, crime-ridden adventure plot that Emmanuel Clase and Better One failed to cash in on essentially rigged pitches. That is an absurd way for me to set this up. Yes, obviously, one of the biggest stories of the season were two Cleveland Guardians pitchers getting busted for throwing pitches in the dirt on purpose to help their pals make some money on a ball one first pitch bet. This one is the one we are highlighting because Andy Pages swung, and it is very funny. Also because we were there. But the item I knew. Jake was like, that was suspicious.
I was like, Jordan, dude, I was saying, Jordan, something's up here, man. Okay?
Could have been the whistleblower.
I tried to tell you guys. Whatever.
We should have gone down into the crowd and see if we could hang out with Better One.
Better One was there, dude.
We were right next to Better One. Game.
Here's what we're putting in. Yeah. Can you imagine me writing that after that game? Sums up. I can feel it in the air. Sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, a billion jokes, obviously. There are parts of this that are not funny, but during this silly podcast, we're going to make some jokes. But this item is very simple. Once MLB is done with it, and the FBI and whoever else needs it, is done with Emmanuel Clase's phone, we're going to take that. Because the phone is really the main character for much of this federal indictment. Because Emmanuel Clase and Better One are just texting, calling, hanging out, going to the same bank, sending him tickets. Like, this phone.
Sending him gifts.
sending him gifts. Of the, ah, sorry, Andy Pye's long. Ah, we lost $4,000, whatever.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. This phone it was the whole thing. If he, you know, here's the thing. Here's the, oh, are you going to make the same joke that I'm going to? Go ahead.
I'm
going
to say, you know what you're not allowed to have in prison? Can't have a phone.
I was going to say, if only Class A had the same phone that the Pope was using, there's no way he would have been able to orchestrate all of this, because he wouldn't have been able to send gifts. He wouldn't have been able, you know, it would have been way more limited communication. But this phone, which seems to have been used at many intervals throughout times that he was not supposed to be using it, was just extremely important. And so, Luis Ortiz, you can keep your phone. If you're going to jail, you can keep your phone.
Our time capsule, much like Kevin Gates, has two phones, one for the crime and one for the Pope.
We moved to June 6th. This is a weird one. This was I think this was a recommendation that we got.
It was.
From an emailer. So I want to make sure.
This one actually begins on March 19th.
Okay.
When Craig Kimbrell, the legendary closer, signed a minor league contract to return to the Atlanta Braves organization. At the time, we were like, oh, that's cute. That could be a great story later on in the year. He went to the minor leagues and played for the Columbus Clingstones. I did not know they changed their name to that. And the AAA Gwinnett Stripers, not strippers. There's just one P. He like played in the minor leagues. He threw 18 innings in the minor leagues with the Braves. And on June 6th, the Braves called him up and they added him to the active roster. And they tweeted about how Craig Kimbrell was back to help the bullpen. There was a tweet that included a sign from a fan. The team was in San Francisco playing the Giants, and a fan held a sign, 11 years, welcome back, Kimbrell. And the Braves tweeted, and they said, welcome back, Craig. And it was like, wow, if he's competent, if he's decent, what a story this could be. And he went out there, and he pitched one scoreless, albeit rocky, innings. And the Braves tweeted, now pitching for your Atlanta Braves, number 46, Craig Kimbrell. And then the next day, they DFA'd Craig Kimbrell.
Literally less than 12 hours later.
That was weird.
That was so weird. What was this? What was this? Thank you to Adam who emailed us. Adam gave us another recommendation we're going to get to later. But this was so bizarre. So we're going to take the sign that the fan who was very excited to see Craig Kimbrell.
As they should have been.
Man, oh man, that was weird. And then he pitched in AAA with the Rangers, and then he went to the Astros, and I just bizarre. All right. June 9th is our next item. A few more, then we're going to take a break. On June 9th, Nolan Schanuel, in a game against the homeless A's, the YOLO A's, whatever you want to call them, hit a ball to left center field, and Denzel Clark ranged back, having already made several ridiculous plays early in his career.
He just camped under it.
Can of corn, not quite, as Denzel Clark basically leaps most of his body, lunging over the center field wall to rob Nolan Schanuel of a home run with what was the catch of the year and one of the great home run robberies that we have ever seen. And so the item that we're going to take is some of the foam from the padding in the fence, because if you watch back, when Denzel Clark jumps up and leaps halfway up the fence, his cleat shreds some of that outfield wall, and you can see some of the padding poking out after this play. So we're going to take some of that padding, that mark that Denzel Clark left, and we are going to put it in the time capsule. Denzel Clark, I am so happy that you are now in our life. Can you hit? Who knows? But it sounds like after DFAing J.J. Bleda, we're just going to get Denzel Clark in center field, and that's pretty sweet.
Can of corn is a term that exists because in the old days, grocers would like knock the cans of corn off the shelves and it was easy to catch, I believe is the origin of that. What's the opposite then? Like a vat of rice? Like what's
what it was what this. This was not an easy play.
This Denzel was a vat Clark. Of rice. What had a play. We put a vat of control. Rice in the time capsule.
All right, three more before I break. Two of them related to the Boston Red Sox. June 13th, Friday night, Red Sox, Yankees. Oh, boy. Wasn't this like the first Red Sox-Yankees game of the season because the schedule was
I believe so. And guess what? It contained the single best at-bat of the year.
Yes. It was second Garrett, time because they had played in New York the week earlier. But yes, they did not play until June.
Garrett Crochet against Aaron Judge. The context here is important. It was 1-0 Red Sox in the top of the ninth inning, and Crochet had been downright excellent all evening long. And the Red Sox, he said, you know what? This is our big dog. This is our war pig. Oink, oink. You head back out there for the ninth inning, Garrett Crochet, to face Aaron Judge for the fourth time in the game. Something that I believe only three or four other left-handed starters had ever done in the history of Judge's career, face him four times in a single game. What resulted was a full count at bat with tons of 100-mile-an-hour fastballs flying in at Aaron Judge. With the count full, the AL MVP-to-be turns on one and sends it 115.5 miles an hour, hurtling through the sky, 443 feet, to tie the game at one. It was the best versus the best. Red Sox still won that game, walking it off in extras. And to commemorate that moment, we are going to take Garrett Crochet's pitch com from that at-bat. Because Crochet was just throwing heaters the whole damn time. And he certainly doesn't need it. There was one cutter in that at-bat, but it was pretty clear that he was going to go down with the heat. And so you really don't need to call the pitches then. So we're going to go ahead and take that. Also, I want to have a pitch com in here because they don't work. Mm.
Yes, yes, yes. All right. But was this the most significant moment of the Red Sox season?
And that was the
most
notable moment of the Red Sox week.
Weekend. Because 2 days later, I still can't believe this happened. The Red Sox traded Rafael Devers. We don't have time or need to totally relitigate this. It is one of the most shocking trades that we have had in our lifetime. Shout out to Robert Murray for reporting it. And everyone Big thinking Bob. He got hacked. But this one is very simple. What item are we going to take? We're taking Rafi's third base glove. First base glove. You could say, it's first base glove because he refused. He didn't need the first base glove and he didn't want to play first. No. It's the third base glove because they basically took that away from him when they signed Alex Bregman. And then when the Giants traded for him, match happens there. So while he did play one game at third later on in the season, if he ever plays third again, he's going to have to get a new one because we have it in our time capsule because Rafi Devers playing third. That is the crux of all of it. As much as it was him playing first, goes back to Bregman, goes back to the Giants, goes back to Casas, goes back to all of it. And yeah, it's obviously one of the biggest transactions of the 21st century. Yeah, that's what it was. Rafael Devers.
July 6th. You intro this one before we take a break.
Okay. July 6th. We wanted to have something to reference the fact that Mike Rizzo and Davey Martinez were fired by the Nationals. This is a huge deal for the Washington Nationals because these guys have just been in charge. They won a World Series in 2019, and their leash extended far beyond when they were... I mean, they've essentially been losing nonstop since they won the World Series in 2019.
Second most losses since, behind only the Rockies.
But they made it all the way till the middle of 2025 until the Nationals leadership decided, that's enough. We are moving on. It is time for a new chapter. And so after the Nationals game on July 6th at home, where they lost to the Boston Red Sox, the news comes out that they've been swept. And the news comes out that Mike Rizzo and David Martinez have been fired together. And so, we could do Mike Rizzo's employee badge would be an option. Something involving Davey Martinez. But we got a little bit of a story here that Jake has been waiting to tell. And we are deciding to unleash it here on the Time Capsule podcast for Nats fans in particular, who will certainly enjoy this. So take it away. Then we'll take a break.
Into the capsule goes a hat that belonged or still belongs to Shinosuke Ogasawara, a hat that has the logo of Andrew Chafin's family farm on the hat. All right, that's up. What? Here's the story, friends. The Nationals, for some time, had been planning to do a dress-up day where everyone on the team was going to dress up as Andrew Chafin. Chafin, a very well-liked veteran journeyman reliever who is something of a character around MLB. If you've ever interacted with him, he is something of a delight. Quite like the man. He is, how do I describe this tree? He's rural and loves it.
Proud.
Rural and loves it.
Yep.
Rural and proud. And he has his own family farm, and the logo on the hat is like the MLB logo, but with a tractor. And what I believe is a little sheep following the tractor around. And anyway, they thought it would be funny. The Nats, if everyone wore a hat and a fake mullet and a mustache and dressed up as Andrew Chafin for a road trip. Hey, guess what? It was the day that everyone got fired. And my understanding of the situation is that the Nationals, after the game, after getting swept, got on their Andrew Chafin outfits, walked onto the team bus. On the team bus, they were then summoned off the bus and into the locker room, where they were informed by the powers that be, I think it was, I assume, the owner of the Nationals, that Davey Martinez and Mike Rizzo had been let go. And the entire team was wearing Andrew Chafin's hats. Many of the guys were wearing fake mullets and mustaches. I think everyone was in flannel. Like Andrew Chafin. And the reason we're taking Shinosuke Ogasawara's hat is because this was his first day in the major leagues after, what, like a decade of pitching in Japan. The Nats signed him over the winter. He pitched in AAA, came up, made his first career start that day, allowed 4 runs in the first inning, went back to the clubhouse. Someone said, hey, we're dressing up as Andrew Chafin. Handed him a hat and a flannel and a mustache and a mullet or whatever. And he was like, all right. And then they fired the GM and the manager. And then they got on a bus and then a plane to St. Louis. And so we're going to go ahead and take, it's one of my favorite stories of the season. I've not told it before this moment. So we're going to go ahead and take Shinosuke's Andrew Chafin costume to go into our time capsule.
Definitely a cow, not a sheep. However, if you would like to buy one of these hats, you can. ChafinFamilyFarms.com. No free ads. On that note, we take a break. When we return, we head to the All-Star break and beyond. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. The beat rolls on and we move ahead to the All-Star Game, the Home Run Derby, which was won by Mr. Cal Raleigh. We are not taking anything that belongs to Cal Raleigh to put in the time capsule, are we, Jordan?
No, we're not. Although, does this technically belong to Cal Raleigh? I don't know. Cal Raleigh won the Home Run Derby. And Cal Raleigh hitting home runs is obviously one of the biggest stories of the season. Of course, the ones he hit in actual games were far more important. But because he also won the Derby, we wanted to commemorate that. And one of the best parts about the Derby for Cal was that it was a family affair. He had his dad throwing to him and his little brother. I'm going hard air quotes here. Because while, yes, he is much younger than Cal Raleigh, he is the opposite of little Todd Raleigh Jr., T as he is called. Is an absolute beast. 15 years old, I believe he's already like 6'5". But little brother of Cal Raleigh, Todd Raleigh Jr., was catching during Cal Raleigh's Home Run Derby performance. And so we're going to take Todd Raleigh Jr.'s catcher's gear from his time behind the plate watching his brother hit a bunch of home runs and win the Home Run Derby. Because it is a reminder of how important catching is in the Raleigh family. It is a reminder that Cal Raleigh was doing both all season long, catching over 1,000 innings en route to 60 home runs. And it's also just a reminder of how awesome this was that the Raleigh family had to have this moment. One of the best stories you wrote this season for sure was about that night. And I love this. I love this. And I cannot believe that this kid is still like three more years away from graduating high school. He's going to be like 6'8", 250. I don't think he's committed anywhere yet. But yeah, I'm very, very intrigued by what happens next with T.
One more Home Run Derby thing. And that is going to be the sports drink themed towel draped around Paul Skeens' neck as he cheered on O'Neill Cruz during this event. Cruz, who hit the furthest home run of the night, a jaw-dropping blast. I believe it was, what, like 503 feet to right field?
I think it was 514.
It was bananas. It was nutso. And at this point in the night, what was so great is that the only people left to cheer on Cruz were all of his Dominican buddies. So it was Tatis, Ellie De La Cruz, Junior Caminero, who was still in the event, and Vlad Jr., and then Paul Skeens. And so it was just all these Dominicans during the timeouts gathering around O'Neill and just like talking rapidly in Spanish while Skeens, the best pitcher in the National League and Cy Young Award winner, just had a towel
starting
nearby.
The next day.
It's like, hey, do you need this? Skeens just, he loves a towel. He's got a towel around him.
He does.
On his neck.
He does.
So we're going to go ahead. This just touches on a lot. So Paul Skeens' home run derby sports drink towel hops into the capsule. The next day offered one of the most memorable situations in recent All-Star game memory as the game finished tied, necessitating the first ever All-Star game swing off. And to memorialize that, we're going to take the L screen from Truist Park that batting practice pitchers Dino Ebel and Travis Chapman threw from in order to conduct the swing off in front of like 10,000 people because everyone at the game left early.
Right. Because no one realized we might get a swing off. I mean, even when the game ended, a lot of people didn't know what was about to happen. Kyle Schwarber homering on all three swings to win the All-Star game for the National League was awesome. And but yeah, the L screen, which presumably they thought they weren't going to need it, they rolled it back out there. And now it goes into our time capsule. We move to July 22nd, a week later. Who takes the mound for the Kansas City Royals but Rich Hill, tying Edwin Jackson's record for most different franchises played for as a major leaguer, 14th different team for Rich Hill. He goes five innings, allows one run as the Royals. 45 years old and 4 months. Unbelievable. He does pitch again 6 days later, but he was not very good. And then that was it. We're assuming that's it for Rich Hill.
Don't do that.
I don't think we've gotten the like, I'm done yet. But just in case, if this was the end for Rich Hill, we want to make sure that the end for Rich Hill is acknowledged because it is one of the most amazing careers that we have ever seen. And his 14th team is very important. So we will take that Royals jersey from Rich Hill.
From an oldster to a youngster, July 25th, rookie Nick Hertz, four baseballs over the fence in Houston for the second, I believe, of three four-home run games we had this season alongside Eugenio Suarez, who we'll talk about later, and Kyle Schwarber, who we'll talk about later. But Nick Kurtz's moment, four-homer game, unanimous rookie of the year, giving A's fans, wherever they may live or live in the future, some hope moving forward. And to celebrate the man known as the Big Amish, because he is big and from near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, we're going to take the horse-drawn carriage road sign closest to his high school, wherever that may be. For those of you who have ever lived or driven through parts of Pennsylvania or Ohio where there are a high number of Amish living, you know the sign that I'm talking about. It is just a yellow square tilted into a diamond with a black horse-drawn carriage. Sometimes it says buggy crossing or watch for, but we're going to take the one closest to his high school and it's going to go into the time capsule.
We head to the trade deadline. We have two trade deadline items.
And the first is one of my favorite ones
of the episode. The two biggest trades, I mean, there were really two massive storylines, one of which we're going to combine. We're going to get to that in a second. But the Mason Miller trade on deadline day, where the Padres said, you know, screw it, we're going for it. But most relevantly, the Padres seemingly decided at some point during deadline week, you know what? We're willing to trade Leo DeVries, our top prospect. A switch-hitting shortstop teenager who could be arguably already one of the top, 20 or so prospects in baseball, And they decided, I don't know what we're going to trade him for. You know, maybe it's Stephen Kwan, maybe it's Mason Miller, maybe it's some other top starter, maybe it's a, but we're going to do it. We're going to trade him. It's going to happen.
And so you know who else learned about that?
You know who else learned about this? Everybody. And so when the teams realize, can we get Leo DeVries in a trade? That's not usually a prospect you can get in a trade. What do? They send their pro scouts to go watch Leo DeVries. And so the item that
guys.
We're, yes, they send all their top guys, go watch this kid. And where was this kid playing? In Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so in the Midwest League for the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. And so what we're going to take is a Courtyard Marriott key card, because that's where all the that's where all the
room
scouts
key.
Stay. At the
it's
closest,
right next to the stadium. It's right next to the stadium, baby.
Possible Marriott to whatever minor league stadium.
No free breakfast.
Where all the scouts were staying.
Yep.
We will take a room key from that hotel for all the scouts that were staying there to watch Leo DeVries that week. He, of course, does indeed get traded for Mason Miller. He immediately packs up his stuff and drives to Lansing, Michigan and plays that night, the day he's traded, because he's a badass and he's going to be an awesome big leaguer. But I just love that. I love
people
that
always
so
say,
much.
Hey, I would love to get into the scouting world. What should I do? Well, the answer is buy a time machine, get in a car, drive to Fort Wayne, Indiana on July 29th, 2025, go to the Courtyard lobby and just pay for some drinks. That's
you'll,
the answer.
You'll be in good shape. Second biggest storyline of the deadline involved the Minnesota Twins trading away 11 players in 4 days. Most notably, Carlos Correa, who they salary dumped back to his former team, the Houston Astros. Obviously, they traded away essentially their entire pitching staff as well, plus Willie Castro, Harrison Bader, Ty France, so many guys. But the item that we're going to take, because we do think Correa is the biggest name here, even though he did not end up making the biggest impact for the rest of the season, but we're going to take Carlos Correa's winter coat or whatever his warmest bit of clothing was that he certainly gathered during his time in Minnesota for at least maybe he's not spending his off seasons in Minnesota, but we know he certainly had some cold early months during his time as a Twin. No longer necessary, as he is now back with the Astros and doesn't have to worry about those cold early months, let alone the offseason. And so, Carlos, it was a nice time, a very strange stint as a Twin. We're going to take that big winter coat because you do not need it anymore.
Not even a little. August 1st, our next item. It's the pocket pancake, baby. Okay, this is like when everyone's freaking out about the Brewers. When the world realizes that the Milwaukee Brewers are for real, they're winning every 5 minutes. And during a Friday night baseball telecast, Pat Murphy reaches into his back pocket during a conversation with Trisha Whitaker, and he pulls out a freaking flapjack and he bites into it. And it went very viral because a manager eating a pancake out of his pocket on television is the type of thing that the people love to see. So we're going to go ahead and take one of those pocket pancakes. Now, are we going to take it? I would probably just say, let's make a pancake, put it in Pat Murphy's pocket, and then take it out. Because the one that he ate on the broadcast has obviously since been converted into another form of energy since then. So we might have to like pocketify a pancake. Either way, this goes in the capsule.
This was win number one in their 14-game winning streak, which we will come back to shortly. But first, a brief diversion as we head to Bristol, Tennessee, where they play a Major League Baseball game, or at least they try to.
Boy, did they try.
On a rainy day in Bristol, Tennessee, 92,000 paid spectators arrived at Bristol Motor Speedway to watch the Braves and Reds play baseball, and the rain said not so fast. Oh, should have built a roof.
Should have built a roof with the field.
92,000, of course, the most ever tickets sold to a Major League Baseball game. That is not how many people were there. However, there were a lot of people there, and it was a mess because it rained, and there aren't usually baseball games with this many people, let alone at, you know, NASCAR stadiums. And so this just seemed to be a total mess. Was it anybody's specific fault? Probably not. Just a tough bounce, but it was a mess. And so we are going to take a poncho recommended by emailer Adam, who also noted Craig Kimbrell earlier. Just take a poncho, whatever the most soaked, just miserable form that represents how messy that day was. The game gets ultimately suspended.
Yeah.
The third inning, they come back and play the next day.
There's no one there.
Definitely not in front of 90,000 people. again, a lot of these Jewel events, we love MLB trying these new things. I hope they keep doing it. This one, for reasons out of their control, was not one that went particularly well.
Another option here would be a plate of wet nachos.
Yeah. Yeah, the food items at this event did not seem super awesome. All right, anyway, back to the Brewers.
It had a little fire fest.
Yeah, it was some fire fest energy. All right, we go back to the Brewers for two more items. And Brewers, that's going to be the end of their items for their sake. All right. Oof. August 9th. Another one of the biggest stories of the year in the shooting star category of whoa, that was like, wow. Did
that's
you
a
see
guy?
That? That was very brief. And then who knows what happens from there. Jacob Mizrowski, one of the stories of the All-Star game. Oh, does he belong? Is this a sham? Whatever. We're not here to relitigate that. What we are here to do is celebrate the very rare Charizard that he pulled opening a pack of Pokemon cards and looking happier than he ever has in his life. Jacob Mizrowski, who throws 104 miles an hour and might be the next great pitcher in Major League Baseball. We still don't really know.
Yep. No idea.
But he's just like a total dork who loves Pokemon.
But
and
this
I
is,
love that. I
the
love
reason that this
him.
Is perfect is because he... more than any player I've ever interacted with, exudes, I'm still a child. Now, maybe that yes. is because we hit the big 3-0, but
yes.
Mizrowski is the first player that feels of a different generation to me. Mm-hmm. And nothing, I mean, maybe this is demeaning, but I think that a Pokemon card represents that childish love for life and exuberance more than anything else. Jordan, how much does one of these cards go for? You are a Pokemoner.
That's a great question.
Me.
The one that he pulled, I'm not sure. Again, I still do like Pokemon, but I'm not really in the trading card space. So I'm sure someone else could tell us. But again, you know, when the rich athletes are pulling the fancy cards, it's not even necessarily about the money as much as it's just like the luck and how much he probably freaking loves Charizard. Which is awesome. It's not about like, oh, how much money am I going to make? It's that Jacob Mizrowski loves Charizard.
I think that is true because as far as I can tell, not that expensive.
Okay. But again, that's the thing. I don't think it's about like, oh my God, I'm going to make bank. He's just a fan of he's a fan of the Pokemon. He's a fan of the OG Pokemon. We stick with the Brewers for one more item. We go to August 14th. And that is the date that they win their 12th game in a row. They would win two more after that, but the 12th win was most important, Jake, because it clinched Free George Webb Burgers, who have this promotion and have a promotion dating back a long time that if the Brewers ever get to 12 wins in a row, free burgers for everybody in Wisconsin. And that is what happened. The Brewers, with that win streak, started with the pocket pancakes. They swept the Nats in D.C., swept the Braves in Atlanta, swept the Mets at home, swept the Pirates at home, went to Cincinnati, won two more games. So we're going to just take a burger from George Webb Hamburgers. I know this is one of your favorite stories of the year.
It indeed is. And I would like to just give an edit. Jordan, according to the Internet Machine, Jacob Mizrowski pulled a 1999. It was a pack of Pokemon cards from 1999 and got a holographic Charizard. And a PSA 10 version of that at Sotheby's is going for $450,000. I would like to...
Obviously, the graded element of that is a little different. But if that's a 10, that's halfway to league minimum.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not a
Oh, yeah, no,
boy.
No. Charizards are kind of a big deal. I didn't know which specific one he pulled, but... That's no joke.
But
shouts
the burgers,
out to Sotheby's getting another.
Shouts out to Sotheby's, baby. No, the burger is great. I think more teams should do this. Just set a very, like, set a get together with a company and be like, there's a 1% chance that this thing ever happens. And then when it does, it'll hit really hard. August 28th, 2 weeks after that, we're going to put in the original Abbott Elementary script that had to be ripped up and or edited when Kyle Schwarber clonked 4 home runs in a single game. The story here, Abbott Elementary, a wonderful television show, was set to record an episode at Citizens Bank Park during a game and had agreed in advance that Kyle Schwarber, the man, the myth, the legend, the Phillies DH, who hit 50 6 home runs this season, would participate in a special guest appearance to be filmed after the game. Now, that got a little bit more complicated when Kyle Schwarber went out during the game and homered 4 times. That meant the script had to be edited, and because the writer was on site, they were able to make some of those changes. They are reflected in the episode. And so what we're going to do is the original script, not the one with the 4 home runs, but the one that was written, understandably not expecting the guy in the episode to hit 4 home runs.
Right. And again, there's so much awesome stuff about this that Schwarber agreed, you know, if he had gone, because he's like, whatever, I'm Kyle Schwarber. If I strike out 5 times, I'll do it. I'm chill.
I strike out 5 times all the time.
Right. All right. We have 5 more regular season items before we take another break. We go to Baltimore at the nadir of the Dodgers season. Having just been swept by the Pirates, the Dodgers arrive in Baltimore trying to show everyone, no, it's fine. We're fine. Everything's fine.
I'm editing it.
On Friday night, Chandler Scott allows a walk-off home run to Samuel Basayo. It's like, oh my God. You just got swept by the Pirates.
Only time capsule they belonged in was deep in the ground. We were like, bury the Dodgers.
This team stinks. There's no chance. It can't get any worse than this. Swept by the Pirates. Crushing walk-off home run. Oh, Orioles stink. What are we doing? Yoshinobu Yamamoto comes out on Saturday and he says, we're done with this nonsense. We're going to get back on track here. And he is spectacular. He is fantastic all the way until 2 outs in the 9th inning. Yoshinobu Yamamoto has not allowed a hit until Jackson Holliday squares up a very good pitch from Yamamoto, takes it out of the yard to put the Orioles on the board. Still only 3-1 at that point. But then Blake Treinen comes in, makes a mess, and then Tanner Scott gives up a walk-off for the second night in a row. Dodgers lose. Oh, my goodness. But the moment that we're really marking here, yes, it helps that we can mark the low point of the Dodgers season, is the fact that we did not have a no-hitter the entire season. For the first time in, I'm forgetting, like...
I think it's 2003.
I don't know if it was that long. But yes, it has been a long time. But what item are we going to do to commemorate? Because this is where we're really tying in a lot of different things here for this item. So why don't you tell people what item we are going to be including for this?
I was wrong about 2003. I'm not really sure when the last one was.
It wasn't that long ago. I think it was 2005. Okay, so pretty close. There you go.
I just got threes and fives mixed up. For this moment, we're going to take a banner of the number one that was hung on the warehouse beyond Camden Yards to commemorate Cal Ripken's 30th anniversary of playing 31 games in a row. And that is part of what made this day so memorable, was it was like, they're here celebrating Cal Ripken. What a player. And Yoshinobu Yamamoto is not going to allow a hit. But he is. He's going to allow one hit. One. Because there was always one. There was always one hit, at least. And so we're going to take that one. We're going to peel it off the wall. We're going to, you know, curl it up. We're going to put it in the time capsule.
Which one? Up to you.
The first one.
First one.
You can see it.
Just making sure.
You can see it in the background as Jackson Holliday hits the homer.
Okay. So the one, not the 2-1, not the 3-1.
The first one. Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah.
All right,
3 days later.
Stick with the Dodgers. Oh, man.
Yep.
This one's also one of my favorites. Roky Sasaki did not have a great regular season. That is a fact.
No.
He came over and was just really bad. Really bad. He was bad. So bad to the point where he was injured. Was he injured? Probably some amount of injured, because he's been injured a lot. But they were like, you got to go to the minors and figure some stuff out, dude. And on September 9th, Roky Sasaki strikes out 8 batters in AAA. He is wearing, for the Oklahoma City Comets, their Copa de la Diversión jersey that says Cielo Azul. So we've got Roky in the alts, in the minor leagues, okay, striking out 8 as a starter for the final time. This is the last time that they let Roky start before they're like, okay, end of this. We have enough starters. Go to the bullpen and just throw as hard as you can.
Less than a month later, he's doing it in the playoffs.
Just dominating. He's pitching in the postseason. At that point, still, we talked on the pod, and we were like, there's no way we're seeing him. I'm like, no, I think we probably will. Said more about Blake Treinen than Roky Sasaki. But we're going to take that minor league jersey, the Cielo Azul jersey that Roky was wearing.
Part of me wishes it was more wonky than that. Cielo Azul just means blue sky. Like, I wish he played a game as like the, you know, the cow tippers or like the, you know, the balled up Sox.
Right. They could have been way sillier. But it's good that it's a minor league jersey. Like, it's like we need it to be, because that's like, again, Ohtani never played.
Roky Sasaki's minor league jersey from September 9th. Okay. September 9th. Let's go 11 days into the future as the regular season draws to a close. We're going to take Victor Robles's unmistakable pink arm sleeve that he was wearing when he made a game-ending double play diving catch to rob Carlos Correa in what was effectively the Mariners winning the AL West over the Astros, the team's first division title since 2001. This game did not actually like clinch it, but it made a comeback unlikely and insurmountable effectively. And this play, which was just amazing. Robles flying into center field, getting the ball just before it hits the turf and tossing it in to double off Jake Myers at second base. As Cal Raleigh said after the game, all he saw was a flash of pink. So we're going to take that flash of pink from Victor Robles because the Mariners won the division, man. And it's more than that, right? Like, it's also the Astros not winning the division.
Yes, doing it in Houston. And I believe that tied the division lead. It wasn't even took the lead. They then, you know, kick their ass on Sunday Night Baseball the next day. But somehow the Astros blowing a 7-game lead over the Mariners was not even close to the biggest division lead blown this season. And that is because the Detroit Tigers coughed up what I believe was it 14.5, 15.5? It was the largest division lead ever to not hold. And that is because the Cleveland Guardians came back and won. And what item are we going to put in for this? September 23rd, I will never forget this game. The Guardians have slowly gained ground inexplicably, and here come the Tigers into town. Series opener, Tarek Skubal on the mound. Skubal's dominating. We go to the sixth inning. Tigers are up 2-0. Skubal fields an Angel Martinez bunt between the mound and first base, and for some reason, he decides, what's the best way for me to get this to first base? By hiking it like a football. That does not work. The ball goes over Spencer Torkelson's head. Chaos ensues. Guard's ball prevails. The Guardians tie the division, take the division lead, never look back. The Until item the we are going to take is a football from Tarek Skubal's childhood garage. Whatever football that Tarek Skubal ever hiked at any point in his life that gave him the physical idea to try this.
Yeah.
It's what we are going to put in, because one of the most amazing things about this is that Tarek Skubal admitted after the game, I've tried this before, which was true. He tried it a year earlier in a game nobody remembered against the Marlins, and that also didn't work. And for some reason, in the biggest spot of the season, he was like, let me try this again. Totally backfired. Tigers lose the division. They obviously get their revenge in the postseason. Credit to him. But this hike was just... Yeah. Just unbelievable. It was one of the most surreal moments I've ever seen in a baseball game.
And you watch it, you're like, Tarek Skubal has hiked a football. Like many of us have, right? Like, right? At some point in his life, he has hiked a football. And whatever that football is that gave him the thought that this was a good idea, I need it. Also, like,
so good.
Cy Young, like, good.
We got his coffee cup. We love Skubal. That's fine.
Now, the Tigers' collapse was not the most embarrassing collapse of the season.
It's a lot of good, tough competition. Tough competition for a lot of reasons.
The podium is quite clear. The podium would be the Astros, the Tigers, and this team, the New York Mets, who, despite fumbling the bag all September long, entered the final game of the season needing a win and a Reds loss. Okay, needing a win and a Reds loss to sneak into those playoffs to face off against the mighty Dodgers in the wild card round. And the Reds did their part. losing on the final day of the year to the Milwaukee Brewers by the score of 4-2. And what did the Mets do? I guess in some ways they held up their end of the bargain, getting shut out in Miami by the Marlins in one of the most embarrassing late season collapses that I can remember. And to exemplify the impossible fact that the New York Mets in 2025 were 0-70 when trailing after 8 innings. I believe they were the only team that did not ever come back. What we're going to take is Sean Manaea's rally cap that never worked. Sean Manaea, who at various points throughout the year could be seen on the dugout steps with a hat folded inside out on his head. If you watch the clip of the final out of the Mets season, it is Francisco Lindor grounding into a double play. And the camera cuts back to the dugout, and Manaea is taking his cap and unfolding it from a rally cap back into an actual cap because the Mets were 0-70 when trying to come back.
And that's the thing. That rally cap, which he really started to popularize last season, famously working brilliantly when Pete Alonso hits that home run against Devin Williams and they come back in the ninth inning against Milwaukee, literally did not work one time.
Amazing.
In 2025. Sorry to Sean Manaea. All right. We're going to take another break. It's so funny, though. we're going to take a break when we return. It's time for the postseason. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbercast. It is time for the postseason. I look outside my window and I see autumnal leaves on the ground. But before they all fell, they were up on the trees in crisp shades of red and yellow and orange. And therefore, there was nothing better than the postseason. And boy, did we have a wonderful postseason. And we will begin on October 2nd, which I think was Yom Kippur night, the night of breakfast. It was also Wild Card Game 3. Yankees, Red Sox in the Bronx. The biggest rivalry in the sport. One survives. One Cancun. And what happens that night? Rookie hurler for the Pinstripes, Cam Schlittler, dominates 12 Ks in 8 innings. Schlittler, a Massachusetts kid who grew up a Red Sox fan, shoving it against his old favorite team. That also set off a very odd Twitter mess involving Schlittler and Yankees fans that we're not going to take sides on. This is all to say, Cam Schlittler, we're going to go ahead and take your Massachusetts driver's license because you're from New York now.
This is an interesting one, though. Fun contrast to the Vlad Jr. passport that we selected earlier, because while I don't know if Cam Schlittler still needs a Massachusetts driver's license specifically, probably a little harder for him to get it, to get a new one
now
than Vlad getting another. Yes, now
Schlittler
Vlad
walking.
Getting another passport. So this is definitely more of an inconvenience in terms of taking someone's legal documents.
Sure. However, his father, John, is the chief of police in Needham, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. So and he's got some hookups. Okay.
Pops could probably grease the wheels a little bit and get him a new ID.
at the old DMV.
The precinct.
DMV or whatever you want to call it. All right, Cam Schlittler. Sorry, we have your driver's license. We move to October 5th. I love this one. On October 5th, the Toronto Blue Jays dominate the New York Yankees. This was the first of several blowouts in the ALDS that they won 3-1. But on October 5th, the Blue Jays won 13-7, and Ernie Clement went 3-for-4 with a home run. The first hit was that home run against Max Fried. This would be the only home run that Ernie Clement would hit in the postseason. However,
almost, barely.
That's true. A couple other close calls. However, it would be the first of a postseason record 30 hits for Ernie Clement in the postseason. And as our way to celebrate Ernie Clement's postseason, we are going to take what he wore essentially before every game that I covered for sure. I think even in the regular season as well. During pregame warmups, Ernie Clement, while all of his other teammates were wearing standard batting practice attire, also weather related, right? Short sleeves, no sleeves, shorts, whatever. Ernie Clement was wearing what we believe was a giveaway on opening day in Toronto, a Bo Bichette City Connect hoodie. So it's the Blue Jays City Connect with a red hoodie underneath. He would also wear a beanie often with it.
It's but like this would, old school thing that like when we were kids, you would get the shirt that looked like a shirt over a shirt.
Yes.
It was supposed to look like two shirts, but it was just one shirt.
It was together. But the point is he would take ground balls in this hoodie the whole season. He did it in LA when it was 100 degrees pregame in the sun. Like this is what he wore all the time. And as we get to double up here, it's also given some love to his teammate, Bo Bichette, who alongside Vlad Jr. with a much more up and down season because of the injury that he dealt with in the second half, missing the first few rounds of the postseason. Bo Bichette is also a massive part of this Blue Jays story. And for Ernie Clement, who led Blue Jays in hits in the postseason, to be repping his buddy Bo for the entirety of the season into the postseason. We love this item. Sorry, Ernie. I'm sure you would like to keep this, but we need to take it because when I think about Ernie Clement, I think about him wearing this outfit. So we're going to take it.
And it's also funny because Ernie Clement from Rochester, New York, seems like the type of guy who could go, you know, short sleeves and shorts in cold weather. Oh, yeah. He probably runs hot. You think?
Yeah.
Apparently not.
Strange.
October 7th, Aaron Judge takes his October demons, crumples them into a ball, and says, I'm good, thanks. We're going to take the entire Yankee Stadium left field foul pole. It is the largest item going into what must now be an enormous physical time capsule. But it's important. Did this swing change the Yankee season? No. It kept it going for one more day. But Judge turning on that pitch from Louis Varland, who also deserves to be in the time capsule
yes.
in some way.
Yes.
And finding a way to keep it fair, and the sound of the ball hitting the pole and the stadium erupting bought Aaron Judge like two more years of being bad in October, basically, in my opinion. Now, I don't think he's going to be, but like for all the tension around who he is and what he's supposed to be, he was unbelievable in the postseason this year. And it was a baseball moment I'll remember for a long time, one that I would have remembered for even longer if the Yankees hadn't showed up the next day and sucked.
Multi-hit games in six of his seven games. He hit 500 in his seven playoff games. That was, pretty though, good. His only home run. But a memorable home run that it was. Speaking of home runs, on that same day, Cal Raleigh, he hit a few homers. Not enough, apparently, to win MVP. But he hit five home runs in the postseason. The first of which, against all odds, inexplicably, how can you possibly explain this, was hit directly to Mariners fan Jameson Turner sitting in left field at Comerica Park. Mariners win game three of the ALDS, and Cal Raleigh hits his 61st home run to a fan who is wearing a shirt that says Dump 61 here. He's the only Mariners fan sitting anywhere out there. It required an opposite field homer for this to happen. And it's just one of the most absurd sequences of, you know, serendipity that we've ever seen between player and fan. And so we will take that Dump 61 here shirt from Jameson Turner, which honestly might already be like requested by the Mariners to put in their personal Hall of Fame. But we're going to take it and we're going to put it in our time capsule.
The next one bums us out. This was one of the more unfortunate on-field baseball moments that we've had in a long time, and that was Orion Kerkering throwing the ball home. in game four of the NLDS. Phillies, Dodgers, bases loaded with one out, with two outs. Sorry.
That's
with
like two the outs.
It's the whole thing. You know what's funny is I was like, oh, he threw home. It must have been one.
Surely it was one out.
Had to have been one. Andy Pages again. Andy Pages, like underrated character in this entire season. Like he's got like a bit of like a 2025 baseball Forrest Gump going on. Where he just keeps exactly finding right. himself. Andy Pages tops one to Orion Kirkering, who picks it up and instead of throwing a first, throws it against the net behind JT Realmuto. The Dodgers win as Realmuto is pointing dramatically towards first base. And we're going to listen to JT Realmuto and we're going to take first base from Dodger Stadium, put in the time capsule. Listen to your catcher.
Just throw it over there.
Throw it to first.
Brutal. Absolutely brutal. I having to watch that earlier to just be like, oh, what item should we do? Made me sad. Sorry, Phillies. All right. We move to Seattle, Washington. Game five of the American League Championship Series, October 17th. The Mariners have lost game three and four in front of their home crowd. Can they give the Mariners fans a moment? Yes, they can, because in comes Brendan Little to pitch. He allows a home run to Cal Raleigh. And then the inning builds further, and Sir Anthony Dominguez comes in and allows a grand slam to Gino Suarez, which resulted in the loudest stadium that I've ever heard. I was there covering it. And courtesy of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, we know that this indeed registered as a minor seismic event. So we're going to take the seismometer. Am I saying that right? Seismometer courtesy of the PNSN that said like, oh my God, yeah, this Gino Suarez grand slam indeed registered as a significant seismic event in the Seattle area. We're going to take that seismometer. We're going to put it in our time capsule. Surely after the Mariners won this game, they went to the World Series, right? Nope. Because 3 days later, George Springer said, hey, Jordan, oh, was that the loudest you've ever heard a stadium? Check this out. I'm going to hit the game-winning home run in Game 7 of the ALCS against not Andrés Muñoz. But what we're going to take to celebrate George Springer's heroic Game 7 home run is a straight ripoff of the item we did last year. Last year, we took Freddie Freeman's painkillers. He was in all kinds of pain as he was the World Series hero. George Springer, after fouling a ball off of his knee or taking a fastball off of his knee.
Mm-hmm. Not a foul.
Earlier in the postseason, straight off his kneecap and was limping around. Clearly just could not move at all, really, for multiple days, if not weeks after this. He just kept on playing, kept on hitting leadoff, and of course hit this home run. So whatever the hell George Springer was taking to get through this postseason.
I want it. I want that.
And deliver some of these big hits. We will take those drugs and we will put them in the time capsule. Thank
and
you.
And honestly, the most helpful thing for future generations.
True. Probably.
You know.
If they're not expired, I don't know how long.
We have to, yeah, it could expire, but like, if you have to dig up all the stuff, probably sore.
Right. That's true. We have one more Blue Jays item before we finish with our Dodgers finales. And that, of course, is simple. That is the pullout couch that Addison Barger's left on before hitting the first pinch hit grand slam in World Series history in game one. This is a pullout couch that apparently already was put on display in the lobby of the hotel. This is just absurd. This is an absurd thing. It's too easy. It's too funny. The fact that Addison Barger was staying with Davis Schneider in Davis Schneider's hotel room the night before game one of the World Series is already funny. Speaks to their friendship, speaks to the story of the Blue Jays. But what a thing. What an absurd thing that was Addison Barger hours. That is what he slept on. That is the sleep that he got in order to deliver that swing.
If the Blue Jays win the World Series, that bed gets auctioned off for legitimately ridiculous sums of money.
Yep. But that is our final Blue Jays item. Listen, there are so many things for the rest of the series that could be Blue Jays positive, but the Dodgers won the World Series, so we're going to focus on them. We begin with another bit of reporting that we never really put out there. Maybe this was included in some other people's stories. But you might have saw that Game 3 went 18 innings.
Oh,
that
had
some interesting ramifications on those in attendance. Not just the people covering it or the players in it or the fans and all those people. But the Dodgers had many, many, many team employees beyond just those who were normally there at Dodger Stadium for that game. And as part of it, win or lose, they were going to have a post-game celebration to thank their staff who have spent the season traveling around the globe to help make the Dodgers better. That celebration never happened.
Why not?
Because this game went 18 innings. And so we heard from people who were invited to said celebration that we know that work for the Dodgers. They were like, hey, yeah, so they just had to like throw away probably thousands of dollars of food.
No, they must have given it away.
Well, right, but to who? Because they were just waiting for the game to end at a normal time. Hours and hours and hours later, they were like, yeah, we're not still doing this. Sorry, guys. Even though we won, this is not an event we can still cater. And so we're going to take some of that food waste and we're going to put it in our time capsule to celebrate the game that would never end.
Until how much of it was non-perishable, we can say. Right.
A lot. This is very disgusting. But we already have some food in here, so why not?
Shohei Ohtani, that night, delivered perhaps one of the greatest games of all time. I realize we're not including the one from the NLCS.
I thought about that. I thought about that.
But we are going to include the one from the World Series.
You could pick something from his 3-homer, 10-strikeout game against the Brewers. That's fine, too.
How about the Brewers scouting reports, both for his on the pitching and hitting side, that did not
work? That's perfect. That failed.
Work.
But what we're going to do is that after he reaches base 9 times, homers twice, couple doubles, 5 intentional walks or 4 intentional walks, he had to go to sleep because he had to pitch the next day. And so we're going to take Ohtani's fancy pillow, which he has bragged about before in his GQ Things I Can't Live Without series.
It's like the first thing you see in the video is him with his pillow.
We wonder, how does Ohtani do it? He gets really good sleep. How does Ohtani get good sleep? I still don't really know, but apparently the pillow has something to do with it. And so we're going to take that pillow from him because it must have contributed to him getting enough sleep to pitch. Not awesome, but better than he did in Game 7.
Like, better than I could still pitched.
Yeah. than anybody else could have pitched, rest. That's for sure. I truly believe better than anybody else could have pitched in that situation. I feel confident that Shohei did the best possible outcome. So we will take Shohei's pillow.
Can I just say again? He went 4-for-4 with 5 walks. 4 of those are intentional, and there were 2 home runs. And then he went to sleep, and then he pitched the next day. And then he went to the podium, and the first question that he was asked was me asking him how much sleep he got. And then that video was put on to Jimmy Kimmel, and I got made fun of. So that was a sentence.
That is the thing that happened. 6 innings.
What a world.
He went 6 innings.
Game 7, baby. Let's do it.
All right, let's do Game 7.
November 1st.
Decent ball game. Could do a whole podcast.
Good ball game.
The Game 7 time capsule.
I might watch that back later.
Let's fast forward to almost the end. Blue Jays 2 outs away from winning the World Series. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Jeff Hoffman hangs a slider. Miguel Rojas.
Yep.
Hits a home run to tie the game. Can't believe it. Can't believe that happened.
Yeah.
I just watched it earlier and I was like, that's so close to the Blue Jays winning the World Series. They're so close. They almost did it. They really almost did it. Now, they almost did it like 25 times. So you could pick all kinds of other moments. Game 6, end of Game 6. Remember that? But this is going to be the Miguel Rojas moment. What are we going to do to celebrate Miguel Rojas here? Well, at the beginning of the season, Miguel Rojas received a gift from Roki Sasaki, who he presumably had just met. And Roki Sasaki gave him some special sake from his native Japan in exchange for Miguel Rojas's number 11 jersey number. Miguel Rojas wore number 11 the last couple seasons with the Dodgers. But Roki wanted to wear 11 because that was his number. He said, here, I'll give you some sake. And then, can I have it? And Miguel Rojas is like, yeah, sure. Sounds good. I'm going to go back to wearing 72, a number that meant a lot to Miguel Rojas because that is the number he wore as a rookie way back with those same Los Angeles Dodgers. And so we're going to take that sake wherever it is. Has any of it been consumed? Who knows? Whether it's an empty bottle or a full bottle, we are going to take that bottle to, you know, represent Roki, to represent Rojas, to represent the duration of a season, all the things that can change in a baseball career, in a baseball season, in a baseball life, the combination, the friendship, the relationship between Roki Sasaki and Miguel Rojas. It's just beautiful. Roki Sasaki, who I guess then, is he pitching before or after Miguel Rojas? He doesn't even pitch in that game.
What are you talking about?
He doesn't even pitch in that game. He was down there. Doesn't have to pitch because Miguel, whatever. Anyway, so much going on there.
Roki Sasaki, who was 4 years old. He was 4 years old when Miguel Rojas signed his first professional contract. Okay.
Now here they are. Having this moment. Wow. Two more items.
Mookie Betts.
I'm excited about this one. Mookie Betts ends the World Series with a double play.
In a good way, though. Not like in the way that Alejandro Kirk did.
Or Francisco Lindor to end the Mets season. Mookie Betts picks it up, steps on second, throws to first base for the first World Series ending double play since 1947. And Mookie Betts, who last year was laughed at as he attempted to play shortstop for several months, rated poorly, moved off the position. And we were like, that was weird. Why do they have him do that? Mookie Betts went into the offseason and he said, I'm Mookie Betts. I can do whatever I set my mind to. And him, with the help of Dodgers Major League Video Coordinator Petey Montero, shouts out to Fabian Ardaya, who reported this earlier this season, was taking an unbelievable amount of ground balls all winter long so that he could show up in 2025 and say, I'm a shortstop. Watch me do this. I will be a Gold Glove finalist. I will end the World Series with a double play, a beautifully turned double play. And no one, will my bat maybe go in the wrong direction?
I will be good enough. I will be good enough defensively that no one will get mad at me for not hitting.
Because I'm not
well.
Hitting anymore. That's fine. Don't worry about that. Because I'm a damn good shortstop. So we are going to take that fungo from Petey Montero, the Dodgers employee who spent all winter hitting Mookie ground balls. We're going to take that good fungo. We're putting it in the time capsule.
To finish things off, game 7. There was no bigger story than Yoshinobu Yamamoto. We're not going to take an item for him. We're going to go to the printer. We're going to print out a tweet. We're going to take that tweet. We're going to put it in the fanciest frame that we can find. We're going to frame that tweet. A tweet belonging to former big league outfielder and current podcaster, Josh Reddick, who on December 22nd, 2023 tweeted, how do you give a guy $325 million without ever throwing a pitch in MLB? That's how. Josh Reddick has been upfront about how he got this one wrong. Give him credit for that. It is so funny how thoroughly he got this wrong. My favorite thing is that when he went on his podcast and said, I don't think I regret it. I'd probably say it tomorrow if they gave that money to someone else. That's just my opinion. I'm allowed to have it on social media. He said that before game 6. Which Yamamoto threw very well in. And then also before game 7, when he came out of the bullpen in one of the most shocking just pitching performances of all time. Crush City Territory podcast is good. Shouts out to friends of the show who host that with Josh Reddick. However, this is just, it's great. So we're going to frame that. We're going to print it out, frame
the whole thing.
Throw down in it's the whole thing.
How do you do it?
How do you?
Well, because he's going to do that. Now, do the Dodgers
direct
know that?
Deposit? You do it via deposit.
Was this the plan?
In large,
certainly not
sums of cash.
But Yamamoto, man, what a freaking thing! And that is what is going to sustain for sure. So while it might take a little bit of time to be like, oh right, Yamamoto, how do you give? Who's this about? Why is Josh Reddick? Who's this tweet? Oh right,
you'll get
because
there.
Because Yamamoto did that. There it is, folks. Our 2025 time capsule. Let us know what we missed. BaseballBarbiecast@gmail.com. I had a great time with this exercise. I hope you did too. That's you, Jake Mintz. That's the producer, Andrew Hartz. That's the listener. You listening. Thanks for listening.
Insert name here.
We are recording this earlier before Thanksgiving. You're listening to this after Thanksgiving. We hope that this is a nice travel companion, perhaps a little off-season break. But the off-season rolls on. We move forward. 2025 is in the ground.
Close the lid on the time capsule.
We don't care anymore. We move forward. Yeah. We move forward.
I'm closing the book, Jordan.
Okay. Jake's closing the book. We are all done. Thank you all for listening to Baseball Barbiecast, Time Capsule 6th Annual. And we will talk to you all next week, where we look forward. Goodbye.
We open a new book.